Hello, I'm Sandy Harper here with my co-host Dick Reichman and our monthly edition of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, literary snacks for the mind and interviews. And today we have a very special guest. It's William Igorak Hinsley, who has just written, did I say that wrong? Say it right, Willie.
Igorak. Igorak.
Okay, that was quite different than the way I pronounced it. Whom has just written a wonderful book called 50 Miles from Tomorrow, a memoir of Alaska and the real people. And it will be officially published and available in bookstores in January, but it's already received rave reviews, such as in Publishers Weekly, the pick of the week. So congratulations, and thank you, Willie, for writing this very honest and insightful memoir.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Of course. And I was just wondering if you could tell us what inspired you to write the book.
Oh, first, the book will be available December 23.
Oh, well, right around
like
the corner.
Well, it was supposed to be like out May and then in August, and you know, it just kind of kept slipping.
That's a publishing world, but in time for holiday gifting.
Yes. Actually, I had hoped it would come out in 07.
Oh.
Because I like the symmetry of 1607, you know, Jamestown,
yes.
Virginia. And 2007, you know, 400 years later, the other end of the continent up north on the other shore, and all that's happened in between.
And a great deal of it is described in your book, at least what happened in Alaska.
Yeah, we were the last holdouts. your question was?
What was that?
You asked me a question,
I was wondering. At one point, you were inspired to write the book. Something gave you the idea, or maybe you were approached by people to write the book.
Well, frankly, I never, in my wildest dreams, thought I would ever write a book. And I really haven't written anything for over 40 years since I wrote that land claims paper back in the mid-60s when I was a student, which to me was the first time I had written anything that in my mind was substantive, that had information that I owned that would have an impact on people.
Well, you certainly found out words had power for what happened after that.
Yeah. Well, I think mostly for me it was the comprehension of a situation that was complicated, that had historical, legal, and political roots, and most people didn't understand the situation. Or if they did, they weren't about to tell us about it. That is, that I'm referring, of course, to the Statehood Act and the mechanisms set up in the Act itself that were in operation at the time I was doing the paper. It was 7 years after statehood. But so I never... Well, the other thing is I think like a lot of my cohorts at the time, we were too busy trying to do what we needed to do to really sort of contemplate our navel and think about anything historic or anything of that nature. We were just desperately trying to do the best we could under some very difficult circumstances, and being so young and inexperienced and in some ways ignorant. If you're sort of in the battle zone, so to speak, you know, you can't sit on the mountaintop as well.
And you don't have that outside perspective.
That's right.
But you were engaged in the championship of the Alaska Native Claims Act.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, it was very, very controversial because people didn't understand it. And in fact, our own people didn't, other than the fact that they felt they owned their territories, which, in fact, they had for literally 10,000 years. That's not to say that they didn't battle to and fro, you know, like other groups do. But still, I think in our minds, and I'm talking about my own experience up north, is that we never thought it was anybody else's land or would ever be anybody else's land, you know. I mean, it was intimate, this territory. In any case...
is that substantially different from the native people in the lower 48?
No, except that, we're in the same places we have been. They got shunted to and fro and got combined with other groups, and they got taken hundreds and hundreds of miles from where they came from to somebody else's territory, right, and put in reserves and essentially prisons.
That's right. And the culture is so connected to the land, it seems to me.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of... But that's what I mean when I'm talking about, 1607 to 2007. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happened in between. But insofar as the question about the sort of the roots of the idea of the book, like I said, I never thought I would ever write one. First of all, there's two or three inhibitions. And I think Native people of all the different cultures up here would probably agree that it's very much the same, and that is there is a, even at this stage of our development, there is a cultural inhibition against blowing your own horn. And it's because, at least in the Inupiaq world, you are pretty much taught to minimize your ego, that you're part of a group, and that you couldn't get too engrossed in your own notions about yourself. You know, I mean, there was even sort of a negative connotation to the idea of looking at yourself in the mirror.
Hmm.
When we got mirrors, yeah. and so because people know that in our history, it took everybody working together to make a life. You know, and if people did good deeds, that wasn't your job to talk about it. It was somebody else's job if they noticed, the great qualities that you had. And so that's number one. And so it's just kind of almost like bad manners to bring attention to yourself.
Historically, has this attitude put Native people at a disadvantage when dealing with...
In a sense.
Government?
Well, oh, yeah. Well, there's other aspects of this situation as well. And also, it was not cool to show too much emotion, you know? In any case, that was one hang-up.
I just want to ask a short question, then please continue your thought, Willie. Is that, would you say this we values, which are of the Native culture... Were those translated into the corporations when they began? Because I know you had a lot with Nana as well.
That's a whole other story.
Okay. Well,
I mean, we can go down many rabbit trails. I think each group is different.
Of course.
You know, and each area has a different historical experience. Each group is evolved differently insofar as the Western world is concerned.
We recognize this great diversity in the different peoples of Alaska.
And it's true that we did have to, in fact, we sort of instilled our values, into the way we functioned in the corporation as well. But fully understanding that, you had to make a profit to make it work, now, that, so I got to point one.
I'm sorry.
Point two is that... there is a question of, first of all, I couldn't write. That's the other problem insofar as thinking about doing a book. I didn't think I could write.
This book is beautifully written.
And then number three is that you worry about your own people's perspective on what you write because, especially in a memoir, you're really kind of bearing your soul. And in the process, you're talking about maybe things that people think shouldn't be talked about, or maybe you might be seen as doing it inaccurately,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe you're better left certain things unsaid, That was sort of another aspect of it. However... like others, I have put my hands on almost any book that I can find that involves the Arctic or Alaska or the Inupiaq people or other Native people over the course of my life. Not that I had a lot of time to read. I, uh, I like to skim through books, and so whenever I traveled around the country and out of the country, I would try to find a bookstore. And, you know, so I picked up a fairly nice little collection of things. Some of them are sort of rare. In fact, I found a three-volume set of Audubon Kotzebue's description of his trip to my part of the world back in 1816, you know.
How exciting. That's why it was named Kotzebue.
And so I've tried to find out a little bit more about that particular family. He was a German employed by the Russians. And in any case, what I began to see finally was that most of what was written about native people up here was always done by somebody else. You know, it was either the explorer, the occasional traveler, you know, a missionary, mm-hmm. you know, a bureaucrat, you know, a teacher, or maybe a trader. And almost invariably, they were completely ignorant about the people that they might have spent their life with. Because they never got into the language, they never understood their mentality, they never understood the significance of their various rituals, dances, ceremonies, and they were there to change them, in a sense, mm-hmm. into something different. And what beautiful things I've read that were written by our people were great descriptions of their lives, at the times of the times that they lived and their experiences. And I'm talking about Jimmy Huntington and
yes.
Sidney Huntington and Sadie Nacook, Sarah Brower Nacook. I'm talking about Elizabeth Bernhardt Pinson and others who've written excellent accounts of their lives and times. But I noticed that oftentimes they never talked about the painful things and about the change, about the things that they're being required to do. About maybe the bad laws or their bad experiences in school or being sent off somewhere or a relative who might have been sent to Morningside in Seattle maybe without due process. And they never talked about the no dogs or natives allowed signs in the bars and in the restaurants, in the theaters. And so to me, while their books were good, it wasn't the whole story. And also, we have had almost no accounts of our generation and all the forces of change that we've had to contend with. And so I did have a sort of a real writer, you know, talk to me about doing a story that I met him at the Geographic, which was just up the street from my office on K Street in Washington. And I finally realized that it was, and I was kind of flattered because I didn't see a commercially viable story in my life, because I knew lots of people who lived lives like mine. You know, we all had to make these adjustments from an old way of life into a modern world and deal with all the pressures of change and being sent off to boarding schools and being away from parents, maybe not learning the skills we would have had at home had we stayed, you know, maybe losing our language, you know, all these kinds of things. And I finally realized that this book was going to be his book about my life, not my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, what the hell? You know, maybe I can give it a try. And so that's how it came about.
That was a very important moment.
Willie Hensley is our guest, author Willie Hensley.
I was just going to ask you, I noticed in the book at one point you got your letters from your grandfather.
Yes, and well, that was really something amazing. You see, most of us know very little about our own pasts for a wide range of reasons, in part because we were all sent off to school. And in fact, it was more or less a strategy of the system to have us not know anything about ourselves, because they're trying to individualize us.
Mm-hmm.
And so all I had was sort of a vague picture of my grandfather, my mother's father. and didn't know anything really about him other than I carried his name, Irgaruk, which, by the way, comes from the word Irgik, which is our word for mountain. Mm. Irgaruk, it's something like a big hill or a small mountain. But it's just a name. We only have one name in our language. Anyway, in a roundabout way, I learned through a lady in Fairbanks, Wagaman, Candy Wagaman, I think is her name, who I've never met, but she apparently was doing some work with the university following various archival materials and historical materials, and she had noticed this lot of items in an auction in Indianapolis, Indiana. And it was letters from Eskimos in Kotzebue, 1915 to 1918. Well, the university didn't get them. I don't know if they bid. But she sent a note to someone who works for a nonprofit that I chair here in town in Anchorage. And this person forwarded her note to me. And so I contacted the auction house in Indianapolis. But by that time, it was sold. And so I wrote this note saying, you know, I'm so-and-so and so-and-so. This is my grandfather. You know? Anyway, so they forwarded my message to someone. It turns out he was a dealer in La Jolla, California, who had bought this packet of letters, 2 dozen letters, and 2 photographs. And so I managed to buy them from him. And lo and behold, 6 of them were written by my grandfather. And I didn't even know he could write. So he was like one of the first generation of Inupiaq people who was learning a different language. And they all were writing to someone they'd never met, who was a pen pal in Elkhart, Indiana, by the name of Isabel Reed.
Isn't that something?
And it turns out that my aunt was named Isabel, and I'm absolutely certain that he named her in honor of his pen pal.
What a treasure.
And
who was Isabel Reed? What was she?
She was just just a lady who was encouraged by the wife of the missionary to be a pen pal to these people.
So signed up through a church or something. Mm-hmm.
Did you get these letters during the process of writing the book, or was this much
earlier? No.
During? Must have had such... Yeah.
And so there were 2 photographs, and it turns out that when my grandfather was a young man, he was a reindeer herder, and there were 2 photographs of he and his cohorts. In fact, one of them I knew when I was a kid. He was a very old man. His name was Nipalock, David White, and sure enough, he was this very young man at the time. And when I knew him, he was a very old man, who was the grandfather of my friend Clifford White. Kayak book,
Wow.
To what extent does your book, Willie Hensley, deal with the long political history that you've had in Alaska and the corporate history? How much of it is politics? How much of it is personal?
Well, you know, I enjoyed politics. And you know, it's amazing how people perceive other people because I was involved. In my mind, out of necessity. I mean, somebody had to grab a hold of this thing and try to do something. Not to say that I enjoyed the political process, but of course, people saw me as primarily a politician.
Originally, when
I was involved in it, but then, of course, once I more or less stopped, it was 4 years ago, I began to focus on business, right? I spent 20 years with Nana Corporation. And so I put a lot of energy into business. So some people perceived of me as a sort of a corporate type.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was always this kind of joke going around. I think Willie Casale and I, he's from the Bethel area, were co-chairs of AFN, and they'd call him Tribal Willie and me Corporate Willie. but you see, to me, all of those activities were not ends but means. You know, while I enjoyed it being involved in politics and trying to solve problems, and there's also creativity involved in, getting things done. To me, it wasn't my life, right? I mean, it was my life, but it wasn't all there was to life. And then same with the business. To me, if business is the end, then God help you. You know, I mean, if people
do it. It was just being pragmatic for the end.
If people do it because they love it, you know, and it gets their juices flowing, fine.
But you had a gift for it, too.
But you know, I enjoyed that, too, as well. Not so much the management end of things, but sort of the creative part of trying to determine, you know, what to invest in, how to piece the things together, and how to make it work.
Well, you know, looking at the corporations, Willie Hensley, from the outside, my perspective is not very deep because I don't know much about it, but it does look like an odd mixture of government and corporation.
Well, isn't that America?
And
look at what's going on now. I
that's
mean,
true.
You know,
oh, that's
I mean,
true,
my God,
yeah.
The biggest corporations in America are begging for government to come in and help.
Well,
so what's the difference?
That's exactly true. Well, I don't know. It seems to me, and I wonder how
I would
you
like
felt
to
about
think
the corporate
that our corporations
nature.
Are more reasonable and practical and sensible than what's going on in America right
but
now.
But are
the dividends
they an appropriate
to go to the
substitute
people?
For governance? As you know, from your point of view as a native person, native
well,
leader, is this an appropriate substitute for government
no,
entity?
Absolutely not. I mean, to me, we could spend a long time talking about this subject.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's not the appropriate time, but no, I think, first of all, trying to create something different in 71 was a virtual impossibility. I mean, they were not about to recreate a system that they recreate a system that the Congress thought had failed, and that was the reservation system. And so trying to do anything different would have been going uphill. And I like to describe it as, you know, what makes Republicans' heart thump is the dollar sign. And, of course, what makes the Democrats' heart go pitter-patter is the idea of helping the poor and the maimed and the halt, the ones that need help. And so, in a sense, you had these two kind of forces sort of coming together to create this.
So there was a fusion.
Yeah, yeah.
And so,
needless to say, the United States has never been particularly interested in preserving native cultures and native identities. They're interested in assimilation because that's how this country was created. They took people from all over the world and created an American. You know, and so that's what they wanted us to do. And so, in a sense, you sort of have to look at the corporate thing as along those lines. And of course, as in so many things, there's both positives and negatives in this creation. And it looks so much like the flora and the fauna of America that it's sort of safe. You know, but at the same time, if you think that's all there is in life as a native leader, that you're strictly a corporate type, well, it's going to fail in the end. And that's sort of the message in the bottle, so to speak, or in the book.
In the book.
Yeah. That is, you know, to me, we have to work hard at keeping our identity, our language, our culture, all those things that make us special in our part of the world, and it takes a bit of concentration.
I'm particularly impressed right now with the mission and what First Alaskans are doing in terms of those goals. You were active with First Alaskans too, weren't you, Willie?
Oh, yeah, I'm chair. Mm-hmm.
I think that's such exciting things that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you want to talk about the book?
I do want to talk about the book. But, you know, all these things are part of what the book is about. But the book
yeah.
is also very, very personal. And I particularly love reading about what it was like to grow up in the old Alaska before modern times
well,
came.
Interestingly enough, excuse me, I've had this frog in my throat. Well, in the process of sort of thinking about, it's for those who are writers or would like to be writers, maybe who haven't written, it's a very tough proposition. I mean, just I am so fortunate to have a reputable, more or less high-class publisher.
Indeed you do.
Oh, and because I was so new at this business that I didn't realize how reputable, you know, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux is. And it turns out that they publish Tom Wolfe's novels. They published John McPhee's books and people
You're
of that
in very
quality.
Good company.
Yeah. So I you know, every day I kick myself, you know, saying, God, how fortunate you are.
And the book tour they created for you was amazing.
Yeah. And so what I did was I was uncertain about my writing ability, so I started, my wife talked me into buying a laptop. And really, this laptop I have in my bag out in the car is, it's been my life, right? And I tell people there's blood, sweat, and tears, literally, on that computer. It belongs in a little museum somewhere. So I started writing these sort of little vignettes, you know, and sort of recollections of this, that, or another. And so in the process, I began to realize that what was commonplace to me in my experience and my memory was not to anybody else. Very few people who've experienced this life, you know, of the dog team world, of the sod house world, of the summertime intense world, and almost constant work out in the country that had been our lot for literally thousands of years. And this was, you know, before the snow machine era and before many of us could afford outboard motors. You know, so where really, literally your locomotion was human strength and dogs, you know.
And adaptability.
And, yeah. And so it was that world that I think the editor who made the decision and people around her wanted me to try to convey, because as we know, Americans virtually know nothing about Alaska, even people who are supposed to be intelligent. And oh. and so I was trying to recreate for the reader, you know, that life. Plus, the more modern experiences of all the pressures and change that we have experienced.
I think you were vividly successful, Willie, and I only wish I'd gotten to read the whole book, because what I did read, it was a page turner, and you just wanted to keep reading, and it was like having the privilege of listening to a wise Native elder, storytelling and lessons, and sharing them with you. So thank you for writing the book.
Well, thank you for asking me about it, and I hope people enjoy it.
I know they will, and I thank our listeners for another edition of the Alaska Radio Reader Rambler. We'll return next month, and in the meantime, I heartily recommend that you get 50 Miles from Tomorrow. It's a wonderful book, and you'll learn a great deal.
Thank you, Sandy.
Please join us again next month for Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.